KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Mike Hunnigan, 90.1 KPFT HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
As always, I like to remind people to make sure you're registered to vote, and vote, and try not to let these off elections sneak past you. Constant vigilance is required. Okay, for our first story from communityimpact.com, the Bel Air City Council considers new Church of Christ parking lot. The Bel Air City Council is considering a specific use permit that will give the Bel Air Church of Christ the green light to construct additional church parking on the northern portion of 8001 South Rice Avenue. The deliberation on the lot comes not only as the Bel Air Church of Christ looks to expand its parking from 70 spaces to 102, a necessity for a church that would help it meet the 100-space minimum required by the city's zoning ordinances, but also as it looks to construct a new building. According to church officials, however, building a lot to meet the needs of its growing congregation was the priority. Coming into compliance with city code was a bonus. The move to build a new parking lot, which was formerly located at 7911 South Rice, is multifaceted. Not only would the church work to construct the lot, but it would also install an underground water detention and drainage system that covers 50% of the lot and 30% of an acre to help offset drainage concerns caused by the additional paving coverage, according to the report. Should the specific use permit be approved, the church would then remove a portion of its parking lot at 1012 Pauline, you don't need to actually know where all these places are, within 90 days of constructing the new parking lot. They would then sell that property for single-family residential use in order to help defray the purchase cost of the land where the new parking lot will go. A petition in opposition to the specific use permit has been signed by several homeowners surrounding the church property. The petition has been reviewed and validated by city staff. Council members Catherine Lewis and Jim Hotze raised questions about why those neighbors were concerned. Lewis specifically requested access to the petition in order to not only see those concerns, but also to identify those neighbors. Councilmember Lewis said, "The one thing I would ask is, those who signed the written protest, did they know that the church was giving up the Pauline parking lot? I don't even know if they knew," she said. "Because of the written protest, in order for the specific use permit to be approved, a minimum of 6 of the 7 member city council will be required to vote favorably as opposed to a simple majority. July 19th is the anticipated date of deliberation for the permit." So the discussion points that I'm thinking of here are, first of all, there's sort of an interesting, if necessary, church-state interface, because you're talking about something that the church, a tax-exempt organization, wants to do, and yet the city, a government entity, has to approve it. And then, of course, you're converting some church property, which is the old parking lot, to new tax-paying property, which is going to be residential use. So I think that's sort of an interesting mix of things in this article, one of the reasons that I found it interesting. Another reason that I found it interesting was, if someone signs a petition, and this was a question which I then confirmed in the affirmative, yes, it becomes a public document. There was a 2010 Supreme Court decision that actually clarified this. So The question then becomes, is it troubling and perhaps chilling that a city council member wants to specifically identify the signers? How willing will people be to sign petitions? I mean, obviously, you know, you're putting your name, your address, your zip code, your phone number. Mm-hmm. You have some notion, perhaps in the back of your mind, this is some kind of a public document, at least potentially. Mm-hmm. But when you have an elected politician saying, I want to know who signed that petition. I want to know where they are. I want to know why they did it. I want to know if maybe they just didn't understand. It's like, do I want, as a signer of a petition, that maybe I did that in front of a supermarket or something, and suddenly feel like I'm being targeted by an elected official who may go on, and it, you know, it happens, to harass me?
Hmm.
So this is kind of why I thought this was an article worth singling out. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the idea of the church-state interface. Now, I initially thought of that as more of, you were suggesting that this was kind of an improper interaction between church and state, and my kind of response to that was, well, this is kind of unavoidable, as long as you want the church to, you know, follow the zoning laws.
More interesting than improper.
Yeah, more interesting than improper, and that's fair. I would agree with that, because if you want them to follow the zoning laws, if you want them to use city services, if you want them to pay taxes, they have to interact with the city.
Put in detention ponds.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the conversion of church property, I mean, again, that's an interesting idea of something going from private religious use to not necessarily public use, but like publicly purchasable use, I suppose.
Taxable use.
Exactly. Thank you. But, you know, land gets reused for different purposes all the time. That doesn't seem too big of a deal to me. But the sort of meat, I guess, here of our discussion is probably going to be around that petition and the idea of public officials looking at who signed petitions. Now, I think that knowing broad strokes data, demographic data, you know, location data, that sort of thing, about the signatories of a petition can help local governments know how broad the appeal of a particular idea is. You know, perhaps, though, knowing names or any other identifying information for people or groups who are particularly passionate or have very specific problems that are coming in front of the city, that may be a bit much. However, there was also...
But that's already... That ship has sailed. The Supreme Court decided that 11 years ago.
That you're right. But we are talking about, I think, the implications of that now. I would say that there is a legitimate concern, I think, in making sure that the signatures on a petition are valid. I don't know if that's necessarily something that elected officials should have access to. Perhaps that should be clerical staff who have the full information and can cross-check it and then can bring up a report or type up a report that they give to the city council that says, yes, the signatures on this petition were all verified, or this percentage of the signatures were fraudulent. But I think that is also...
And the Supreme Court case was around transparency in government.
Right, right. And so this is a transparency issue, and it's one worth talking about. I just don't know if... I don't know if city officials or even state officials or federal officials are looking at publicly available petition records and targeting people based on that often enough for it to be a thing to be worried about.
But the question here,
I acknowledge,
is
it could happen.
An elected official specifically said they would like to know who those people are, and then goes on to say maybe they didn't understand. And when they frame it that way, it's not a huge leap to think, and maybe this council person, because especially Bel Air is a relatively small city, to think that this council person might now take it upon themselves to personally or have their office contact these people, try to clarify it to them, try to educate them. And at a certain point, you know, is this harassment? And while this information has already been decided at the highest levels to be public, do you really want officials talking about, I want to know who signed this? And what kind of a chilling effect does that have now if for people alert to this anytime they're faced with a petition, whether it's signing a petition for a candidate to get on the ballot, signing a petition to start a war, to end a war, to endorse a public project, or, you know, we're going to talk about high-speed rail a little later. How often will you want your name on a petition if it's possible that some marginally unhinged politician might decide to look you up personally?
It's a good question. What is the level of acceptable risk?
Exactly. And what is the control on that acceptable risk? Our next story from communityimpact.com is HISD approves $2,500 pay raise for teachers, with another bump possibly coming in August. The Houston ISD Board of Ed approved a $2.2 billion budget at its June 10 meeting, including a $2,500 raise for the roughly 12,000 employees on its teacher salary schedule. That raise could be boosted further at the board's August 12th meeting. The move passed unanimously, but only after board member Elizabeth Santos initially called for a $5,000 raise, an amount that Chief Financial Officer Glenn Reed said could put the district in a challenging position with regard to its reserve funding. Though not required by law, the Houston ISD board follows a policy requiring the district to keep at least 3 months' worth of operating revenue, or approximately $469 million, in its unassigned reserve fund at all times in case of emergency. The budget amendment from Santos was itself amended by trustee Ann Sung, who lowered the amount to $2,500 and required the district's budget staff to come back at its August meeting with a recommendation on whether teachers should get an additional boost to the $5,000, perhaps. Santos said she called for the raise because she believed it was time for the teachers in the district to have a more competitive salary with surrounding districts. HISD teachers were paid a competitive starting salary of a little over $54,000 in the 2020-2021 school year, according to district information. By contrast, starting teacher salaries in SciFair were about $56,000, KDISD about $55,500, and Spring Branch ISD was about $58,000. Now, along the lines of you get the government and government employees you pay for, the tax rate in the budget is slated to be a maximum of almost $1.13 per $100 of valuation, which is down from a little over $1.13, according to a press release from the district. However, the district will not adopt a tax rate until later in the year after appraisal values are confirmed by the Harris County Appraisal District. The district is projecting an enrollment of roughly 197,000 students in the 2021-22 school year, down about 10,000 from the previous year, Reed said. So I think the next story is what makes this interesting. SciFair ISD proposes employee raises in the fiscal year of 2021-22. Again, from Community Impact, SciFair ISD board members are considering a 3% pay raise for employees district-wide, and increasing starting teacher salaries from $56,000 to $58,000 in the fiscal year 2021-22. So what makes this interesting is HISD is raising their salary to become more competitive, and SciFair is raising their salary to become more competitive.
Yeah.
So it's an arms race. It's a fiscal arms race. And ultimately, when you're talking teachers off the air, Andrew and I were talking about some of the things we learned way, way back in elementary school that still stick with us, that we still use literally and figuratively as rules of thumb. And I think, you know, when you think about teachers that you had when you were 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, and at my age of 70 and at his age of 22, and we're still referring back to those things in our everyday lives of writing or doing stuff or whatever, and you consider how much a teacher is worth and how much a good teacher is worth, and I think that makes these things seem a lot more immediately accessible to individuals.
Absolutely. Andrew? Yeah. I mean, my thinking about both of these stories is obviously it's very important, it's very interesting that we might be seeing a teacher salary arms race, which I mean is great for the teachers. But, you know, my general thoughts are pay teachers, fund learning materials, raise taxes if you have to, but for God's sake, let these poor folks have a proper meal for once and not have to buy their own classroom crayons.
You get the government you pay for and the government employees you pay for.
That's true. Donna Lord, the president of the SciFair Teachers Union, mentioned in a Cypher ISD board meeting, she said, "You were exploiting your teaching staff. It's time to step up and show us the respect we deserve."
The district had increased their workdays by 15 minutes a day, which equated to 47 additional hours by the end of the school year with no additional compensation.
Right. And she was saying this to get the board to consider those pay raises. She's absolutely right. They are being exploited. Although, you know, from a materialist analysis here, they will still be being exploited no matter how well they're paid, because labor is entitled to all it creates, but profit is made by taking what labor creates away from labor. That still will happen. Still.
But this isn't capitalism. This is government, and it's really important to keep the two distinct.
Well, under capitalism, education systems do produce a product. They produce students who become workers who then work in private institutions. So, I mean, you know, we can have this argument, but...
Maybe we will. The government technically is not a profit-making institution. It's a non-profit governmental institution.
That's true.
The question here is, how much are the citizens willing to bear as a tax burden in order to fairly pay, fairly being highly debatable, to fairly pay employees doing specific tasks for the government?
Sure. But, you know, I think that the government under a capitalist system is still very much intertwined with business and profit. And this is an example of that. However, increased pay will improve teachers' material conditions and put them in a better bargaining position for their unions. And, you know, if you're inclined to do so, maybe even an overthrowing position. So, again, just pay teachers.
And as far as performance goes, morale matters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 HD2 KPFT, Houston's community station. We now air live on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org. You can also podcast it on your podcast app on your phone. You can visit archive.kpft.org. Or, of course, you can listen to it on HD radio, which, you know, is an option. Every story that we do on this show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post for the show or the show date you're looking for. You can even search by keywords in the search bar. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, or on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, because I have no imagination, and Andrew has his own social media accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and on Tumblr, spelled the same, at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Our next story, again from CommunityImpact.com, the Texas Supreme Court declines to review high-speed rail case, freeing the company up to use eminent domain. This is actually an important story. Texas Central, the company looking to build a 236-mile high-speed rail line connecting Houston and Dallas, has been given a big win in an ongoing legal battle over whether the company is legally recognized as a railroad company under state law. The Texas Supreme Court denied the review of a case from June 18th that was part of a legal challenge first launched by landowners in 2016. The decision frees up Texas Central to use eminent domain if necessary to acquire tracts of land needed to construct the project. According to Texas Central CEO Carlos Aguilar in a statement, the court's denial of review should put an end to over 5 years of contentious litigation and clear the path for Texas Central to bring high-speed rail to Texas. Jim Miles and his team won a trial court case in 2019 arguing that Texas Central is not an operating railroad because it does not own any trains and has not constructed any tracks, among other issues. That decision was reversed in appeals court last May. We actually talked about that on the show, which ruled that Texas Central was a railroad company and an interurban electric railway. In a statement, the opposition group, Texas Against High Speed Rail, said they were disappointed in the Texas Supreme Court's denial of review and that the complainants would be filing a motion for a rehearing. Officials with Texas Central have previously said eminent domain would only be used as a last resort. However, Miles and the other landowners, the complainants along the route, have refused to sell to the company, meaning eminent domain could end up coming into play. So the first question here, and again, we've talked about this, the benefits versus potential drawbacks of high-speed rail. In theory, high-speed rail is a great idea. Europe has it. Japan has it. Other countries have it. The question in the United States is, if you build it, will they come? So what will high-speed rail, aside from the potential, and actually this doesn't happen in the case of the Houston-Dallas transit, if you can go from like downtown to downtown, theoretically, mm-hmm. that can be a plus, yeah. bypassing things like airport security, assuming that that continues to be the case for rail, could be a plus. The ability to travel perhaps in a little more comfort, being able to get up, walk around, maybe more comfortable seats. We'll have to see about that. but here are some of the drawbacks, especially in this particular case. The high-speed rail would start or would terminate in Houston at what is now the Northwest Mall, basically the corner of 290 and 610. It would then stop, more or less, in College Station. But it wouldn't be like downtown College Station. It wouldn't be like the Highway 6 route that's more or less in the heart of College Station. It would be sort of a few miles off to one side, kind of like Intercontinental isn't exactly in downtown Houston.
Right.
So you're talking about a stop in the middle of a long high-speed route that is not exactly close to downtown College Station, not departing particularly close from downtown Houston, which may or may not be a plus, I don't know. And I'm not sure exactly where it terminates in Dallas. So what are going to be the attractions for people? If you are going from Houston to Dallas or the other way around, you're not taking your car. So I guess you're going to get taxis and or rent cars, as opposed to the drive, which is about a 4.5 hour drive. And I guess with the stop in College Station, that will slow things down a little bit. And then, of course, aside from all of these considerations and more, there's the eminent domain question. In the 19th century, railroads got a specific carve-out for eminent domain in order to facilitate connecting the country through rail, which is why that question of, is this an operating railroad came into question. Now, eminent domain doesn't mean you can confiscate land. It does mean that you, quote, have to pay, unquote, the market value or reasonable value for the land. Of course, ultimately, the determinant of that is whatever institution is using the eminent domain.
Sure.
And, you know, if you have contiguous land and you don't want to have a railroad having a parcel in the middle of it, you know, these are questions. These are individual rights, property rights, business rights, human rights in some ways. So these are all really fundamental and important issues. Andrew?
Well, to talk about the benefits and drawbacks of high-speed rail, a common refrain among, I think it's fair to say among socialists, is train good, car bad. There are a few reasons for that. Just more efficient, you know, carrying a lot more people for per person less fuel than if they were all traveling by car. I think that same would apply here. Also, less chance of accident, I think, because fewer independently, you know, moving around drivers and vehicles and stuff. But that kind of doesn't apply if the train is environmentally and or socially destructive, so destroying communities. And personally, I don't trust a private company like Texas Central to care about the environment or their impact on communities. So I think it's probably a good idea. I'm not going to, you know, go and join Texas Against High-Speed Rail yet, but I think it's probably a good idea for us to keep an eye on this thing. Now, talking about eminent domain, eminent domain is misused all the time by police who see something in a suspect's car and go, mine now. But I recognize that sometimes individual property should be given up for public good.
That is not the same thing. When you talk about eminent domain, you're typically talking real estate.
Interesting. Okay. Well, regardless, I think that we should make sure that it's being applied to private property, so land, machines, and means of production for infrastructure purposes rather than personal property, such as your toothbrush, for any purpose they like. Now, there is a difference there, but I think that if I'm confusing the two, perhaps that's indicative of a lack of education, certainly on my part, but perhaps on other people's parts.
Well, if it's you, I'm sure it's many.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you can illustrate the differences for me.
Well, eminent domain is typically for things like railroads, shipyards, if it's in the national defense interest, for example. Essentially, social goods as defined by the government. The government is, in a sense, a monarch, okay. which is where the notion of eminent domain comes from in English common law.
Yeah.
So anything that the monarch needs, the monarch has the right to take. And that was refined later by saying, but you also are entitled to a fair market price when the government or the monarch decides to take that real estate. Right. Now, I mean, you're talking about confiscation of illegal property and stuff like that. That is certainly a thing, but it is not eminent domain, which, as I understand it, at least, is strictly involving real estate, typically privately owned, converted to what is considered to be a public good.
Well, I could have sworn that it's the same terminology is used for both, but instead of me looking it up, why don't we issue it as a fun challenge to our listeners? Go ahead, Google it for us. And
we should have thought to do this in advance and provided the link, but we didn't. So we is your challenge.
So this is your challenge.
Eminent domain. This is your homework.
And I'm not going to make Mike sift through all those comments. Send them to me on my socials at DominateEy, that's Dominate EYE on Twitter and on Tumblr. And tell me how good I'm remembering things or how stupid I am. And
No. Ignorance is a correctable condition. Only stupid is forever.
You're right. That's a good point. So how well I remembered it or how ignorant I am. There we go. That's much
better than stupid. I don't even call my cat stupid.
That's a nice thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I use very, very sparingly. You're either ignorant or you're incapable of learning.
Mm.
Stupid is, you know, that's a little different, in my opinion.
Mm.
Fair. Okay. Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. And you may have heard about this already. Governor Greg Abbott vetoed criminal justice bills, legislation to protect dogs, and teaching kids about domestic violence. Mm. He vetoed 13 bills authored by Democrats and 7 by Republicans, which is about the ratio of Republicans, the Democrats, and the legislature, which is interesting. 12 of the vetoes targeted bills that originated in the House, 8 originated in the Senate. I will note that there are explanations and links to explanations for his line item vetoes. You can go to my website, thinkwingradio.com. You can click on the link for the article. You can read it in its entirety. I just want to say that because this is going to be, again, heavily excerpted. Abbott's most explosive veto came Friday when he signed the state budget but used his line item veto to reject funding for the Texas legislature, its staffers, and legislative agencies. The move was retribution after Democrats broke quorum in the final days of the session to block the passage of Senate Bill 7. A GOP elections bill that would have overhauled voting rights in the state. Abbott's office declined comment for this story to the Texas Tribune. Among the bills Abbott vetoed over the weekend was House Bill 686, which would have allowed earlier parole eligibility for inmates convicted of certain crimes if they were younger than 18 when the crime was committed. The bill would have required parole panels to consider the inmate's age and mental state at the time of the crime, among other factors, when determining parole eligibility. That was vetoed. HB 686 was authored by Representative Joe Moody, Democrat of El Paso, included in Republican House Speaker Dade Phelan's bipartisan criminal justice priority package called Smarter Justice, Safer Texas. Another House criminal justice priority bill vetoed was Senate Bill 281 by State Senator Juan Chuy Hinojosa, Democrat McAllen, which called for a ban on using statements, this was interesting, obtained through hypnosis in a criminal court. I didn't even know that was a thing. If passed, the bill would have helped bring an end to a controversial practice that law enforcement in Texas used close to 1,800 times over the course of 40 years, according to the Dallas Morning News. Yeah. Hypnosis. And hypnosis has been proven to be highly suggestible depending on how it is conducted, assuming a person actually falls under a state of hypnosis and isn't potentially faking it, which you can really only prove with an electroencephalograph.
Yeah.
All kinds of stuff. Another bill that fell victim to Abbott's veto was Senate Bill 474, known as the Safe Outdoor Dogs Act. Apparently, this is the thing he's going to get the most heat for because people, dogs, huh? The bill would have made it illegal to chain up dogs and leave them without drinkable water, adequate shade, or shelter. It also called for a ban on tethering dogs with heavy chains. I'm disappointed in the governor, said Senator Eddie Lucio Jr., Democrat of Brownsville. I don't agree with everything Abbott does, but I respect him when it comes to quality of life and protecting life. I want to include dogs in that issue. Abbott said Texas already has the statutes in place to protect dogs from animal cruelty, and the penalties proposed in Lucio's bill seemed excessive. A key issue of the legislative session was protecting and expanding broadband access, particularly in rural Texas. House Bill 2667 would have provided universal service fund assistance for Texans. Abbott named broadband access as one of his priority items for the legislative session, but he shot down the bill, saying it would have imposed more taxes on Texans everywhere. So my opinion is you get the government you pay for, as I often say. As a state, we need to support each of our citizens in certain things, even if it means taxing you for something that doesn't at some point in time directly benefit you. So for example, you may live in Houston and have high-speed access, and then you may move to the Hill Country and suddenly find you don't. Well, should you pay taxes while you're in Houston for people in the Valley or the Hill Country that don't have it and only pay the taxes for it when you move there? Or should we all be paying it kind of like insurance? I mean, this is what insurance is. And, you know, some Republicans don't really understand the concept of insurance, even though they claim they do. So what a lot of people don't understand, the story continues, is that there are still parts of Texas, including parts of the rural district that this individual represents, Representative John Smithy, Republican of Amarillo, where you don't have access to internet. Some areas don't have access to cell service, and some don't even have access to landline phones. Greg Abbott also vetoed Senate Bill 1109, which would have required middle school and high school students to learn about child abuse prevention, family violence, and dating violence. He said in his veto explanation that he opposed the legislation because it doesn't give parents the option to opt out of instruction. And of course, if you come from an abusive home, your parents might want to opt you out of this instruction. Abbott also vetoed Senate Bill 237, which would have reduced penalties for criminal trespassing by allowing police to, quote, cite and release individuals instead of arresting them. All of Abbott's veto statements were released on Monday and are available on the link associated with the article and which is on my webpage. So I think the thing to talk about here in sum is the idea of the line item veto by the executive, whether it's the president or in this case, a governor. There was a time in my life, probably back in the Nixon era, when we had Nixon, for all his faults, in many ways was a competent, effective president. He actually did good things like the EPA. Now, he might have done them under political duress, but he did them nonetheless. And there were times when I thought a line item veto was a good idea because sometimes Congress is dysfunctional and they throw totally unrelated bills into legislation. And it seems like a good idea for the executive to be able to cut that stuff out. What I have come to with age is I'm sort of against the line item veto because the point of the legislative process is, in normal times, functional compromise. The art of the possible. And when a legislature of elected representatives has come to a compromise that gives certain things to certain areas and certain things to other areas, and in many cases, with an umbrella of doing something for the overall public good, when the executive line item vetoes things, it fundamentally changes the intent of the legislation. So that's the point I've come around to. Andrew?
Okay. Well, in my view, line item veto is kind of like the filibuster in that it can be used to your benefit and to your detriment, depending on who has the power to use it. I personally like line item veto because I think it makes for a more flexible legislative process, and it reduces the chance that a bill that the public likes will get torpedoed by an unreasonable writer. I think that if it's implemented, it should be made sure that the legislature still has to sign off on the executive's line-itemed version of that bill, though.
Okay, that's an interesting option. I mean, my feeling is that the line-item veto essentially makes the executive a dictator. That, you know, they can't just take or leave what the legislature passes. They can choose and cherry-pick what they like out of it. And, of course, what we have learned over the last few years is you can't always trust an executive to do what's in the best interests of the city, county, state, or nation.
Agreed.
So that is kind of where I come from.
I understand that feeling. I feel like if I was an executive of something and I had the line item veto power and I had nobody looking over that with oversight, that would absolutely be too much power for one person to have. But I think that an executive only having the ability to approve or deny entire legislation from a particular legislature or legislative session means that minor tweaks that may be necessary to approve that bill, you might have to wait a year for, depending, or 2 years or 3 years, depending on how frequently your legislative session is. So with this line item veto, with the requirement that with the requirement of legislative assent, the legislator or the executive can suggest those tweaks, can make those tweaks, and then put it back to the legislature for, you know, is this acceptable? Can we compromise on this? It is further opportunity for compromise. So I think it kind of enhances the process when it has the appropriate safeguards.
Well, in principle, I actually kind of like your idea. I think that it's a good check and balance. I think in practice, it would end up being so time consuming that nothing would get done for years. Because if you think about it, if the executive line item vetoes something and then it goes back to the legislature so they can look at the newly created bill that the executive has given them, to then have to schedule that for a vote. And especially since it's a bicameral legislature, that means that the House and the Senate have to schedule it separately. Mm-hmm. And if there are any changes that one or the other House makes, then it has to go to a reconciliation meeting, and then it has to be voted on again, and then it has to go back to the governor again.
Sure.
And this can become sort of an endless chain. So, you know, again, while I like your suggestion in principle, I don't know how it might work in practice.
I wonder if maybe having the legislature's leadership might be enough of a balance, but I think we could probably workshop this for the rest of the show if we wanted to, and I'm not sure we have the time to do that, unfortunately.
But I do think it's an interesting idea, and maybe someone can make it workable if you're going to have a line item veto. So, you know, there may be a middle ground between having a line item veto and not having it. Interesting.
Interesting.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 HD2 KPFT, Houston's Community Station. KPFT always needs your community support, so we want to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the newly recreated kpft.org and hit the donate button, pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, which can be large, small, or in between. We are grateful for whatever you can afford whenever you can afford it.
Absolutely.
And you might qualify for a lovely thank you gift. You can also donate by texting the word give, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Or, you know what? Doesn't cost anything to just spread the word and tell people about the station, your favorite shows, suggest they sample this, that, or the other. We'd appreciate that as well. Okay, our next story. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, again, this is from the Texas Tribune, sets a July 8th date for a special legislative session on the voting bill and other issues. Abbott's office did not specify what legislative priorities will be included on the special session agenda, and said in an advisory that such items, quote, will be announced prior to the convening of the special session. Abbott had already said that he plans to ask state lawmakers to work on two priority election bills and bail bills that died in the final hours of the regular legislative session, after House Democrats walked out of the chamber. More recently, Abbott said the agenda for the legislature's overtime round will also include further restricting in schools of the teaching of critical race theory, which refers to an academic discipline that explores the role racism plays in institutions and structures of governance. After the legislature adjourned in May, some Republicans said they plan to change at least one controversial provision in the bill that dealt with the window for early voting on Sundays. The last-minute addition to the bill had raised concerns it would harm get-out-the-vote efforts by black churches. Republicans, including Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor, have asked the governor to include legislation that would ban the practice known as taxpayer-funded lobbying, new to me, and another that would restrict the participation of transgender student athletes in school sports, two items that failed to pass the regular session. Meanwhile, Democrats and left-leaning groups have called on Abbott to include items such as fixing the state's electric grid and expanding health care, a topic we're going to get to shortly. We're not going to go down without a fight, and we will never stop fighting to protect the rights of all Texans to cast a ballot, said Carissa Lopez, political director of the left-leaning Texas Freedom Network, in a statement Tuesday. So in this article, the cash bail bond issue, this is something House, that actually...
House Bill 20, which was a priority legislation that died.
Okay. The issue of cash bail bonds, though, is something that was addressed recently in Houston. And the idea is that there are people who are indigent, who cannot make a cash bail, who may not be ongoing threats to their neighborhoods or the public at large, and that people that can't afford bail shouldn't essentially be incarcerated without without a trial indefinitely. So that's an important issue that apparently the state needs to hopefully catch up on. Issues on the electric grid? Well, we just had a massive power failure during a freeze, and it's like, well, at least we have enough power for the summer. And it's like, oh, we're in danger of a massive power failure in the summer because in the winter they didn't expect the cold, and in the summer they didn't expect the heat. So as I said last week, I believe it was, I think we need to rename the Electric Reliability Council of Texas to simply be the Electric Council of Texas. Reliability should not be their middle name. As far as transgender athletes, I have to admit, this is an issue that I am not sure about. It's, I mean, I believe very strongly in equality under the law. I believe very strongly in equal rights for all individuals, regardless of sexual orientation or ethnicity or religion. I mean, I just don't think it should matter. Human rights should be the same for all individuals. My concern, and I think it's based out of a certain level of ignorance and uncertainty on my part, is when you have a male transitioning to a female, does that person have a physiological and or anatomical advantage in competition with equivalent peer female athletes? From articles I have read, rightly or wrongly, there are female athletes who do feel that male to female trans athletes have a physical advantage. Is this correct? Is this just anecdotal? I don't know. And I guess that's something I need to do more self-education on. Andrew?
Well, to go back to the first item on the list, cash bail. My feelings, abolish cash bail. If you're rich, it's not a deterrent. You just pay to get out of jail. If you're not rich, it makes it harder for you to maintain your job, which can make you lose your job, which will destabilize your life, even if you're found innocent and can get another job, to say nothing of the emotional impact that being separated from your family has. So I think
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it's worth remembering that the point of cash bail isn't a punishment. It's a guarantee to appear in court. That's all it is.
Right. And if they can find another way for the rich to be guaranteed to appear in court, well, they can find it for the rest of us, too.
Sometimes they lift passports.
True. The Texas electric grid is a mess, and that mess has a body count. Yes. From the freeze that we had a few months ago. Any politician that is postponing the fixing of that mess, in my opinion, has blood on their hands. And I think no more needs to be said on that, really. Now, the transgender athletes issue. There is no reputable evidence, as far as I can find, to suggest that people assigned male at birth, who then transition to be women, have any advantage when competing in sports or any other circumstance over people who are not assigned male at birth. So this can include cisgender women, people who were said that they were women when they were born. There is an NPR source that goes over this. There's a link that I am going to try and get into our blog post for this show that you can follow there. There are other sources that go over this. There are sources that disagree. And if you compare the two, I think you'll have a very educational lesson in what sources are trustworthy, to be honest. The fact remains that these laws are just discrimination. And in a long and storied tradition, the laws use protecting children to justify that discrimination. In my opinion, students, this is your cue to tell your lawmakers that you oppose these bills. College, high school, junior high, elementary, whatever level you are in, you have transgender classmates. And if you care about other people, I believe that you have an obligation to stand up for them.
And of course, it's worth noting that in some cases, you have transgender classmates that you will never know are transgender. And shouldn't, because it's private.
Yeah.
And people are people.
People
are okay, people. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 HD2 KPFT, Houston's community station. We now air live on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on HD2 KPFT. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it on your phone, or visit archive.kpft.org. And it's worth repeating, and that's why I repeat it, that every story on the show is heavily excerpted. Which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. We're also on social media, where we take questions, comments, and suggestions, and be kind. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, or look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And Andrew?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and on Tumblr, spelled the same, at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. This is really interesting. Texas congressional Democrats proposed the bill to let local governments expand Medicaid without state consent. The bill would let counties and cities apply to the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for funds that were declined by their states. So local governments could implement their own Medicaid expansion programs. This legislation was introduced by U.S. Representative Lloyd Doggett, Democrat of Austin. In Texas, that could mean as many as 1 million newly eligible residents, most of them people of color, who fall into the gap because they can't afford private health insurance and can't qualify for subsidies. Sponsors of the bill include all of the Texas congressional Democrats and most Democrats from the 12 other states that have refused to expand Medicaid. It is the first time local governments have been able to directly contract with the federal government for Medicaid funds. The bill allows counties, cities, and other political subdivisions to apply directly for funds that were declined by their states, including Texas. What makes this interesting is there is a 10th Amendment clause that says powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are essentially reserved for the states. That's the shorthand. So I think that this is fascinating. I think if it becomes law, it's absolutely going to be tested in the courts up to the Supreme Court. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a conflict, but honestly, I don't care. The material effects, more people on Medicaid, more people alive. Good.
Totally agree, but, you know, court. Okay, you may have heard New York City has a Democratic mayoral primary proceeding with ranked choice voting after no candidate wins a majority outright, according to CNN. Since no candidate will win a majority of the first choice votes, tabulation will continue in rounds. The candidate with the fewest votes, there are five running, I believe, five primary candidates, main candidates. The one with the fewest votes after the initial count will be eliminated. And then all the ballots for that candidate gets reallocated to the next highest rank. So, for example, if number five is eliminated, then that person has second choices on their ballot. Those second choices will then get allocated to the various candidates. And they will keep eliminating candidates until finally, with the additional choices, the first, the second, the third, the fourth choice, somebody ends up with at least 50% plus one. So they don't have to go into primaries or runoffs, rather. And it could take a long time. They could end up doing this sometime through July before they actually come up with an answer because it becomes more complicated counting. I think what's interesting about this is this is the largest political subdivision in the United States that has attempted ranked choice voting, or as Rachel Maddow has suggested, calling it 1-2-3 voting. The state of Maine has ranked choice voting, but they only have 1.3 million people. Just Brooklyn has more than three times that population. So this is a very, very significant test.
Yeah.
And I think depending on how well or badly this goes, I think is going to be a major influence for elections around the country and hopefully federal elections, because frankly, Joe Biden, the first president I can remember since maybe Richard Nixon, or perhaps Ronald Reagan, or maybe not, Joe Biden is the first one in decades to actually get over 50% of the presidential vote. And that just isn't a way to run a country. For me, the poster boy is the Maine governor, Paul LePage, who never got over 38%. But because of the divided vote, he got two terms as governor. You know, Hitler got 38% when he formed a government. Just saying. Andrew? Mm.
Well, I love ranked choice voting. It's the only voting system I've seen yet that actually lets a voter make their thoughts about the entire election heard rather than just a specific candidate. I believe it is the best way to hold an election. I believe it can work at any scale. I can respect the intimidation factor, though. And for voters, a simpler name like 1-2-3 voting, as suggested by Rachel Maddow, could help. But I'll be very interested to see how well it works in the New York election.
The next story is from Politico.com. Interesting. Mm. The city of Buffalo, India Walton, is on the verge of becoming the first big city socialist mayor in 60 years. The political newcomer and unabashed socialist is on the verge of a Democratic primary victory on Tuesday night. If Walton holds on to her lead and goes on to win the general election, she could become the first socialist mayor of a large American city since Milwaukee's Frank Ziegler, who left office in 1960. Organizations such as the left-wing Working Families Party made Walton's campaign a major priority. With over 99% of in-person votes counted, Walton is leading with 52%. The Democratic nominee is always the overwhelming favorite in a Buffalo mayoral election. Voters haven't sent a Republican to City Hall since John F. Kennedy was in the White House. Now, for me, one of the interesting things, I don't normally discuss article tags, but this was tagged ride hailing, New York ride hailing. And it's like, aside from New York, everything else in the article is more important than ride hailing.
Mm.
So there's that weird aspect of the article. The other thing is, you know, I and Andrew have sort of an ongoing discussion of the role of third parties versus the role of a binary political party system. And what I think is interesting, I've said many times, I don't have any particular objection to third parties in principle. I just think that they should start out grassroots running for more local government positions, which then gives them an opportunity to show what their policies will do, how well they can govern, how successful they ultimately are, and work their way up the political food chain and maybe become a major party. I think what's interesting here is the strategy. There is a fusion party rule in New York State that's a little different from others, where you can cross-nominate candidates from other parties. So the Working Families Party is actually its own party, and they have, you can say officially or unofficially, depending on how you look at it, endorsed India Walton. But India Walton, who is an avowed socialist, is running under the Democratic banner, which, in my opinion, as an analysis, gives her political legitimacy. I don't think that she could have a chance. I don't think she would have a great chance running, quote, as a socialist. But running as a Democrat who happens to be a socialist, I think, is what makes the difference. Andrew?
Well, I don't know much about Ms. Walton, other than she is running as a Democrat. And thus, I'd say it best, she's a social, small-d Democrat and not a socialist. But I will say that I think that even a social Democrat will make more material improvements to people's lives than a corporate, capital-D Democrat will. So given the choice between her and her Democratic establishment incumbent opponent, I wish her luck. On the question of third parties sort of doing this cross nomination thing with major parties, I think it's interesting. I don't think that it's necessarily all that great of a strategy, because I mean, the Working Families Party doesn't seem to have seen much success, in my opinion. But you know, I think that third parties, I think it's better for them to stay independent of the political duopoly, because they kind of exist to challenge it, in my opinion. So that's what I think.
But on the other hand, just briefly, I say many times that the people are the party. The party is not the people. So when you have third party individuals that begin to run successfully under a duopoly banner, those ideas get adopted into the political mainstream. And ultimately, I think that is the ultimate goal of third parties, although, of course, they would prefer to be in power themselves. But what they do is contribute to the cross-pollination and evolution of politics. Andrew, do you have anything you want to add, since otherwise I'm taking the last word?
I disagree with that, but that's fine. We disagree.
Okay, it happens. There you go. All right, next story is from the New York Times. The Federal Reserve Chair says the United States needs, quote, more inclusive prosperity. Jerome Powell, Federal Reserve Chair, said Tuesday that the central bank was focused on returning the economy to full strength and emphasized the Fed would be more ambitious and expansive in its understanding of what that meant. This is the thing that I thought was really interesting. Powell said there is a growing realization, really across the political spectrum, that we need to achieve more inclusive prosperity, citing lagging economic mobility in the United States. And my first thought was, across the political spectrum? Really? Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the polling, whatever the Republican political establishment is doing, Republican voters often feel differently from the political establishment. And of course, Democrats feel the way Democrats do. So I don't see how across the spectrum there's recognition. Andrew?
Well, yeah, I'm calling that one. I mean, Republicans are absolutely not concerned with inclusion or prosperity for anyone except themselves and their donors. I think the Democratic establishment is very similar, except they like it for their image. Few Democrats who do care are limited in what they can do. Besides, there's a fundamental problem to me with this idea of making prosperity more inclusive. Just having more, for example, disabled, Black, gay, and women CEOs is not going to resolve issues of inequality that are fundamental to how capitalist societies like the U.S. operate. If those people can get to the top without taking the usual advancement path of stealing the labor of others, then great, more power to them. Maybe they can spread their methods and improve workers' lives. But if they can't, or they choose not to, and they end up at the top anyway, they're just another capitalist, reinforcing the system and its flaws.
Well, you can make that interpretation, but I don't think that's what Powell was saying, at least in terms of what he intended to mean, whatever he actually means.
That's the problem with his vague statement.
Well, like, I mean, yeah, political statement. But I think that his implication is that more wealth needs to spread more down. How far down and how it spreads down, those are obviously the issues here. But I think, again, the thing that caught my attention is when he said across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
That on its face just ain't right.
No.
Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and kibitzing partner is Andrew Ferguson. We look forward to speaking to you again next week. Hope you found the show interesting. You all take care.
See you later.
Time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, each two-hour program uses an hour to discuss issues and organizations of importance to prisoners and their families to help educate and inform our listeners. The second hour broadcasts shout-outs, live calls from inmates' family and friends so inmates can hear their loved ones speaking on the air. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT every Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM, KPFT, or online at kpft.org. Houston's Community Station.
And the the forecast for KPFT does call for a chance of showers and thunderstorms, otherwise partly sunny with a high near 93. For tonight, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, 79 the overnight low. And then for Thursday, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, otherwise sunshine, a high near 95. Thursday night, we'll see a clear sky, a low near 78. That's the forecast for KPFT.
This is not a test.
Tune into the Dead Time Radio Show for 3 hours of punk, hardcore, industrial, death rock, noise rock, experimental, grindcore, and other forms of non-corporate of punk, hardcore, industrial, death rock, noise rock, experimental, grindcore, and other forms of non-corporate underground music. Every Thursday night, Friday morning at 2 a.m. on KPFT Houston.